Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm going to be reading some archived articles from True West Magazine. True West, August 1960 edition. Apache Laws by Miles M. Collier. Mangus Colorados, the great Mimbreno Apache chief, captured a Mexican girl and wished to take her to be his wife. According to Apache law, Mangus Colorados should have either killed her or turned her over to his wives as a slave. Both of his wives had the right by Apache law to appeal to their relatives, which both did. Mangus Colorados was challenged by a brother of each wife to the terrible Apache duel, naked, with knives as weapons, and death to the vanquished. Mangus accepted, and before all the people, the great Apache slew his challengers. The Apache Indians had a number of unwritten laws concerning tribal life. Some of these unwritten laws governed such things as trials, adoption of children, preparation of a warrior, the obtaining of salt from the salt lakes, and the different dances pertaining to different social events, Thanksgiving, and of war. The trials of the Apache were simple affairs when compared to the complicated procedure carried on in our modern courtrooms. In every case, the wronged person had the right to settle the matter on a personal basis if he so desired. If the wronged Indian was unable to meet the offending parties in a personal encounter, he, or anyone, might in his stead inform the chief of the wrong, and then it became necessary to have a trial. Both the accused and the accusor could have witnesses, and these witnesses were not interrupted with questions and were not placed under oath, as it was believed the witnesses would not give false testimony in a matter regarding their own people. The chief presided over the trial, and in a serious offense, he could ask two or three leaders to sit with him. These leaders only determined if the man was guilty. If he was not, the matter was ended, and the complaining party lost his right for personal vengeance. If the accused was found guilty, the injured party fixed the penalty, and this penalty usually was confirmed by the chief and his associates. The Apaches had a custom of adopting many of the people they captured. This was especially true of the children. Many captive children that were adopted by the Apaches grew up as Apaches and took an active part in tribal affairs. The laws governing the adoption of Apache children was fairly rigid. If children were orphaned by war or otherwise, or if both parents were dead, the chief could adopt them himself or give them to someone else if he so desired. The outlaw Apaches could take their children with them, or if they were left with the tribe, the chief would decide what was to be done with them. In any case, there was no disgrace attached to the children. At an early age, the Apache boy was given a small bow and blunt arrows to play with. The earliest training received by the boy was by his maternal grandfather and his father. The boy, when large enough, was taught to make his own weapons. His woodcraft education began when he was first taken on a hunt by his father. This was always a proud and long-awaited day for the Apache boy. The basic raiding and fighting unit was the local group, so it was natural for it to assume the responsibility of training the youth for the warpath. This training usually began by the time the boy was 15 or 16. Sometimes several boys were trained at the same time, either in the early spring or late fall. The youth were required to take dips in cold water and sometimes to plunge into ice water. He had to do long runs over rough country with a pack on his back and was required to breathe through his nose and must be able to make his own weapons and show skill in using them. He was put through all the hard exercises engaged in by the men. To test his willpower and endurance, He was made to go without sleep for long periods, sometimes as long as 48 hours. This training went on for a long time until he was able to conduct himself like a real Apache, regardless of how severe the test. At last, the youth might volunteer to go on the warpath. A war dance was performed in his behalf, and he was given a helmet and shield, especially designed for him. At this war dance, he was expected to demonstrate his agility and endurance by leaping and twisting and dodging with unending pep and endurance. He was instructed in the language of the warpath. Just as soon as he became well-versed in all of it, his request to go with the war party was granted. During his apprenticeship on the warpath, there must be four such war parties, he must build the fires, prepare the food, and cook it. Look after the horses, stand guard at night, be constantly alert and observant, and never speak except in the language of the warpath. These four war parties constituted his war college. If at the time of his fifth war party he was considered made of the right stuff, he was allowed to take part in battle. The Apache boy missed not a chance to show his mettle and to return rich with the spoils of war and covered with glory. The war dance of the Apache was always held after a council of the warriors had deliberated and prepared for the warpath. This dance is accompanied by the beating of the Esadadin and has the usual singing led by the warriors. The dancing is more violent, and sometimes the yells and war whoops almost drown out the accompanying music. Only the proven warriors are allowed to take part in this dance. The Dance of Thanksgiving was held in the summer after the gathering of the fruit of the yucca, which was ground and made into cakes. The tribe would assemble to feast, to sing, and to give praise to Usin. The prayers of thanksgiving were said by all, and when the dancing began, the cakes were carried by the leaders, who added words of praise occasionally to the usual tone sounds of the music. The social dances usually were given as a coming-out party for a chief's daughter when she reached the age of puberty. These dances lasted for 2 or 3 days, with the young girl taking a very active part in the activities. The entire tribe is invited, and many friends of the tribe are also invited to attend. Everyone takes part in the dancing, even the friends of the tribe that has been invited. The Apaches, like many of the other Indian tribes of the United States, obtained their salt from lakes. Their source was a small lake in the Gila Mountains. The salt lake is shallow, and the bottom of the lake is covered with a brown crust. The salt adheres to this brown crust when it is broken. The pieces of crust may be washed clean in the lake, but when washed in other water, the salt will dissolve. When on salt gathering expeditions, the Indians are not allowed to kill game or attack an enemy if he should come to the lake. All creatures are allowed to come and go as they please without molestation. Laws controlled the Apache Indians' activities just as effectively as our laws govern the things we do today. True West Magazine, August 1960 edition. Bisbee's Five Black Ghosts. Murder and violence were a part of frontier life, but this particular wanton killing of the innocent women and men was just too much for Arizona Territory. By A.D. LeBaron. In the twilight hour, when most residents of Bisbee, Arizona, were going home or were already quietly having their supper, nobody really noticed the five horsemen rein up at the Goldwater and Castaneda store. But up the shadowy street a few yards, Mrs. Alma Roberts was coming to make a late purchase. Abruptly, she froze in her tracks. The five men had dismounted, and four were removing their hats while one stood guard. Mrs. Roberts watched as the four pulled stocking masks over their heads. Eye holes had been cut in the stockings, so that in the dim light, the masked men became veritable ghosts. Moving swiftly, all drew their pistols. Three, including the man wearing no mask, walked through the front door. The other stood guard. Mrs. Roberts screamed. One of the bandits turned and shot from the hip, killing the woman instantly. Bisbee is a canyon town where, of necessity, the houses are on stair-step levels. Up 80 feet from Main Street, three tiers high, Dave Rousseau heard the shot and ran to his front porch. Noise of the pistols again echoed up and down the canyon. Rousseau's body toppled down a rooftop, to a boulder, to a lower roof, onto a rocky slide, then into the street. The three men on the porch were deployed now, backs to the store door, guns in each hand. As the people of Bisbee, aroused by the shots and outcries, came running from their homes and places of businesses, more shots rang out. There was no thought of defense, no opportunity. The black ghosts simply shot without warning at everything that spoke or moved. But for the dim twilight, dozens might have been slain. Meanwhile, action inside the store was equally tragic. At day's end, the Messrs. Goldwater and Castaneda had been preparing to close. One held a box containing the day's receipts and stood before the open safe. "Hold it, Goldwater," a voice called. Mr. Goldwater turned. A black ghost faced him with two guns. Mr. Castaneda was waiting on a late customer, R.E. Duval, fitting him with a pair of shoes. Both men half stood, mouths open in surprise. "Stand still," the second ghost ordered them, also holding guns. "Get everything from the safe, put all the money you have in this bag, and be quick." This command came from the leader. All of it took a matter of seconds only. It was unbelievable. Though this was 1883, Bisbee was civilized now, a mining town with considerable prestige and order, not given to wildness in recent years. The store proprietors and the customer were dumbfounded, but the pistol shots were roaring outside. Mr. Duval, the customer, did not obey the order to stand still. He snatched for his gun. Instantly, a ghost fired and killed him where he stood. Duval seemed to be fixed there, upright for an ageless moment. So Mr. Castaneda described it later. Then he slowly turned on one foot and crashed over a table of shoes, blood flowing. Mr. Goldwater put all the safe's money in the bag, about $3,000 of it. Much of it belonged to friends, stored here for temporary safekeeping. The bandit made him tie the bag with a stout cord, then hooked his pistol and arm through the loop of it and started out. The store men were trembling, in anger as much as fright. Anger and horror at what they realized was taking place. Then the bandit leader paused for a few seconds. Beside him was a showcase of jewelry. A hard swing of the gun in his free hand shattered the glass. He holstered the pistol, reached in and grabbed a handful of rings. Then he took two of the prettiest watches, turned to his hooded companion and said, "Let's go." Outside, all five robbers leaped to their horses and clattered off into the darkness, as unrecognized and as mysteriously as they had appeared. The whole swift action had taken less than 3 minutes. Sounds of the horses' hoofs were still echoing when more curious citizens arrived on the run. Fortunately for them, they were a few moments late. As a crowd gathered, they stood appalled at the carnage. A half hour of excited talking and shouting had to pass before calmer men could fully understand what had occurred. By then, four bodies, including Mrs. Roberts and that of Deputy Sheriff Tom Smith, were resting on the store porch. J.C. Krigbaum, a respected citizen, stood there holding a rifle and sobbing over the loss of a close friend. Presently, Mr. Krigbaum spoke. I will ride to the county seat with the news. Some of you prepare fresh horses and equipment for the posse I'll be bringing. It was 30 miles to the county seat, but it was already a famous town and held some officers destined for enduring fame. Its name was Tombstone. The sheriff there was John Bean, who had figured in the notorious Earp Clanton feud. A distinguished shotgun messenger for Wells Fargo was Robert Paul. A third, hard and sensible man was W.L. Daniels, deputy sheriff assigned to Bisbee. Kriegbaum killed his horse racing those 30 miles, but when he told the officers in Tombstone his tragic story, they rode back with him instantly. The 60 miles in one night all but killed Kriegbaum, too. "There is not a clue or anything else to go on, gentlemen," Mr. Goldwater told the officers. "Just five nondescript men, four wearing black stockings over their heads. Could have been anybody in the territory." "Black ghosts," sobbed a woman. She and several more stood near, crying. Silent men waited, holding their guns. Bill Daniels answered her gently. "Yes, ma'am, but the time will come when those men will wear black stockings once more and be ghosts forever." A sad and bitter citizen lifted his rifle and prayed, "God help us make it true." He spoke for all of Bisbee, and ultimately for all the Southwest. No other episode in history aroused greater fury among the men and women who opened our wild frontier. With so little to go on, the posse was at its wits' end for a while. Deputy Sheriff Bob Hatch took charge. He gathered every possible detail about the murderers and their horses, made notes, listened to suggestions, but still didn't know where to start searching. Then a volunteer came. "Name's Heath," said this one. "New in town, but I have a lot of experience trailing, and I know all the back country hereabouts. I could be your guide." They accepted his offer at once, lacking a better one. And so, with the earnest good wishes of the populace, Hatch's posse rode off. Heath was in the lead, and right away declared he had picked up the trail of the hooded killers. He'd ride with his eyes on the ground and report things he said he observed. "Can't see all of them little signs myself," Bob Paul protested a time or two, out on the wild, semi-desert land of southern Arizona. Heath assured him it took trained eyes and know-how, so Hatch and the others followed. After several hours, though, they jumped Heath again, and this time he declared he had lost the trail. He acted ashamed and began a slow, circling, searching hard. "A rocky ledge had made it hard to follow any sort of trail," said he, "and it seemed like a valid alibi." Sure enough, toward sundown of that day, he shouted that he had found proof of the trail again. They believed him, followed a while, then camped and rested. But the next morning, he lost the trail once more and admitted it. Anger had arisen against Heath now, and truly he had accomplished nothing. So Deputy Hatch ordered him to return alone, and the posse would continue on its own. But after four more days of hard searching, all the men rode back into Bisbee completely whipped. The black ghosts had disappeared as mysteriously as real ghosts might have. The funerals had all been held, but the anger of the populace was still high. Heath declared he was ashamed he lost the trail. Bill Daniels and Deputy Hatch decided to resume hunting as a pair. They rode out at considerable risk. In that era, the whole region was infested with savage Apache Indians, and two men would have been easy prey. They had to risk it. They circled wide, visiting all outlying mines and ranches, quietly making inquiry. Them devils had to stop somewhere for water and food and fresh horses, Daniels reasoned. They were approaching the Frank Buckles ranch at the moment, though they had no reason to hope for encouragement here. They had simply spend the night and rest. Sure glad to see you fellows, Mr. Buckles declared, pumping his hands. Mighty lonesome, living off this way. Haven't heard a mite of news since John Heath and his men stopped off here nigh on to 3 weeks ago. A man's family gets restless, and... What'd you say? Hatch interrupted. Did you say Heath? Why, yes, sir, Heath, it was. John Heath, you want him? What'd he want? Why, nothing much, except some horses. I sold him 4. Got cash money because I didn't like his outfit much. Like as not their cattle thieves and be riding my own stock. You take that Dan Dowd and Calmer Sample, they look mean. Sample's redheaded. You gents know him? And a fellow named Jack Howard. If we ranchers could prove they'd been rustling cattle, we'd... Who else, Mr. Buckles? Daniels interrupted the lonely, talkative rancher. Well, let me think. Best I recollect, one was named Delaney, or some such like. And a Dan Kelly. Mean-looking outfit, I tell you. Kept eyeing my wife. I'd ought took him and run them off, but there were 6 to my 1, and... You done right, sir. Just be careful, and thank you kindly. Daniels and Hatch rode out a ways to confer, and Hatch spoke again. All right, then, you ride wide among the friendly Mexican families and take friendly redskins you can find. Take little gifts and some silver money. Shine the coins up bright. What'll you do? Daniels asked. That Dowd, he's wanted for a stage holdup near Benson, and I think Buckles is right about all of them. So I'm going back to Bisbee and arrest John Heath. He found Heath without trouble. The man was acting hurt because the posse had dismissed him as a guide. But Hatch took no chances. He arranged with a friend to approach Heath from 2 directions, and on signal, each drew their guns and confronted the man. In a matter of seconds, they had handcuffed him. He protested loudly, insisting he had simply lost the trail when trying to guide the posse. You're lying, Heath, Hatch snapped. We did our own guiding, with good success. Dan Dowd talked. So did the others. You are left here to spy on us and hold down any pursuit, but you were actually left holding the bag. That broke Heath. He started swearing vengeance on his erstwhile pals, and in his fury of cursing, he revealed everything the deputy needed to know, except where the other 5 might be hiding. Hatch now had all the names and something of their plans. Quietly, he rushed Heath away to Tombstone to prevent the Bisbee citizens from lynching him. Meanwhile, Bob Paul had quietly been gathering some hints and clues. He found that the ranchers of the region all knew about Dan Dowd and his bunch of alleged cattle thieves and were willing to help find them. Also, the ranch folk gradually filled in detailed descriptions of the 5 wanted men. The political situation in Tombstone was shaky. Sheriff John H. Behan lost out in the election, being replaced by J.H. Ward, who appointed new deputies but retained Deputy Hatch. Sheriff Ward took over active direction of the hunt for the Bisbee killers. Sheriff Ward began doing some detective work on his own, visiting all the towns and villages of the region, spreading descriptions of the men and details about their murderous foray into Bisbee. Among the towns visited was Clifton. There, Ward was approached by a young miner who said his name was Pickering. You say one of them robbers stole 2 watches? That's right, Ward nodded, and described the watches. One had been especially valuable, with diamonds in the case. Well, there's a man here, calls himself George Lincoln, the young man explained. He taken my girl from me, I guess. Seems he gave her a lot of valuable stuff. Amongst it was a diamond watch. Do you reckon maybe... Sheriff Ward did so reckon. He considered the information carefully. A man named Lincoln, fitting the description of Sample, was flashing money around and was traveling in the company of a man resembling Howard. He sent word immediately to deputies Hovey and Hill of Graham County. A posse took after and outran a Surrey rented by Sample and Howard, who were unsuspectingly taking two girls for a ride. Concealed by the roadside, they waited for the Surrey to come within range. Suddenly, with drawn guns, the posse stepped out onto the road. "Hands up," commanded Hovey. "You, Howard, drop your gun. Then drop Sample's. You women stay still." One girl had been sitting on Red Sample's lap. He threw her across the Surrey dashboard as he went for his pistol. Sample instantly received a serious wound. Both men surrendered now, begging for mercy, hands high. Unfortunately, it was not that easy. The girl, tossed onto the horse's rumps, was screaming. The Surrey horses, stampeded, started to buck. Hovey shot one of them through the head as it fell in the harness. It pulled the other one down, helpless. The panicky girls got up and fled on foot. The two men were disarmed, handcuffed, and headed back to town. A posse man's horse replaced the dead one. Sample didn't die. A few weeks later, he and Howard were ushered through an iron door in Tombstone. When the lock had clicked behind them, they recognized a third man huddled there in the dim light on a steel bunk. It was John Heath. For a long moment, the newcomers glared at him, and he at them. Three of the black ghosts of Bisbee were already in reunion. 6 weeks had passed, but the horror of the massacre in Bisbee remained fresh in people's minds. Three of the killers were accounted for, including Heath, their scout. That left three to be found, and hints of them began to pop up in many strange and curious ways, no doubt because people were so incensed toward them. One day, Bill Daniels was approached by a very elderly Mexican who almost whispered a word of advice. "Señor Daniels, mi amigo, it would be wise if someone made a little trip to Sabino." Daniels, knowing the Mexican people, played it cool. He asked no impulsive questions, and he just nodded, then calmly said, "I could go, my good friend. Perhaps I should have more than one name to use. Is good?" His friend nodded and faded away. Daniels understood. He had been given a valuable tip. Sabino was a village in Chihuahua, deep in Mexico. Daniels surmised that one of the robbers had fled there and that the Mexican grapevine had reported him. So Daniels posed down there as a New York buyer of smelted mine ore and thus had outward reason to be in the village. He acted boldly, frequenting the few cantinas and generally acting his part. And it paid off. He spotted Dan Dowd in short order. He could not just go up and arrest Dowd. For one thing, this was Mexico and he had no authority here. For another, Dowd might have friends that he, Daniels, couldn't know about, and they might well shoot the American officer down. So Daniels waited until night. When Dowd was walking in the shadows after a night of carousing, a form stepped from behind a tree just behind him. There was the muffled sound of a blow. Dan Dowd groaned and sank to his knees. Daniels handcuffed him, gagged him, and carried him bodily to a wagon and team he had rented. He dumped his man in without ceremony and quietly drove away. It was a dangerous and uncomfortable trip, but he thus got his man back to the international line and into Arizona. Part of the trip was in an empty boxcar on a train, and most of the time, both men had to go hungry. But at the end of it, the cell door in Tombstone opened once more, and one more ghost was added to the reunion. Bill Daniels then resumed work in Arizona territory. As an Indian might, he started circling, searching for some hint of a trail by spreading the word again, asking for any kind of relevant information, offering rewards for any news of value. His work consumed weeks, months, but he went doggedly on even when it seemed hopeless. Friends told him the two remaining killers probably had fled to the Pacific Coast or Mexico City. He kept on searching. One day, in the town of Deming, New Mexico, where he had spread the word of his search among the merchants, a Mexican shoeshine boy came running down the board sidewalk and stopped, panting before him. "Señor," the boy gasped, "El Barbero, the man, she is need you, she have to raisings, quick, you come, El Barbero." He struggled with his English and his breathlessness, but he tugged at Daniels's arm, and the man began walking with him. Finally, Daniels learned that raisings should have been razor, a razor in the hands of a barber. But where? What? Down the street, two blocks, was a barber shop operated by Augustin Salas, a very fat and jolly citizen given to much laughter. He was not laughing when Bill and the lad arrived. He was standing over a customer in the chair tilted back as usual, and the barber held a very sharp razor at the customer's throat. This scene has since been dramatized by Western artists, notably Lon Maraghi of Phoenix, who hilariously pictured the barber's anything-but-hilarious situation. Several frightened men stood waiting with the barber when Daniels arrived. "Señor, officer," Salas greeted him. "Quick, the handcuffs. These men come for a shave with the much whiskers. I cut them off. I look. Aha! Is the man Kelly? I say to him, 'You're Kelly.' And I feel his neck muscles get tight. Is proof, huh? No es verdad?" It was true indeed. Kelly lay there under the blade, not daring to move, but cursing. Daniels acted fast. He disarmed the bandit, snapped handcuffs on him, and took him away. He tried to pay good citizen Salas a reward, but that gentleman refused it. The Mexican boy got a fortune for his work, $20 in gold. The Salas barbershop got priceless word-of-mouth advertising all over the region. Bandit Kelly got a quick reunion with the other black ghosts in the jail at Tombstone. The ghost roster in captivity now showed only Bill Delaney as missing. And he might be anywhere in a radius of 2,000 miles, the officers knew. By now, almost everybody in that area knew of the Bisbee crime, and sooner or later, Delaney would do something to reveal himself. Once more, the Mexican grapevine showed life. It suggested that Daniels go to the town of Minas Prietas in Mexico. He had a detailed description of the man and took a Mexican along as guide and interpreter, along with the fellow officer. Near the town, they halted, but sent the Mexican in alone, carefully briefed. We can reconstruct his part of the drama from his own report. He found Delaney without trouble due to the accurate description and to the fact that few Americans were in town anyway. So he approached him direct, as the officers had suggested. "Señor Delaney," said he, "I have a message. A friend asks you to come to him." The man stiffened a little, but remained calm. "You got the wrong party, fellow," he said. "My name's Summers. You must be mistaken." The Mexican smiled. "No mistake, señor. This friend said to tell you he is Dan Dowd." "Oh, well then. Yeah. Where at is Dan? Can you take me to him?" "Seguro, see?" They rode out together inconspicuously, as if on business in the rural areas. Presently, the Mexican pointed to two saddled horses in some shrubbery and smiled, then lingered behind. Delaney, no doubt lonely for companionship, dismounted and walked right up to the horses, calling happily, "Hey, Dan, old man, where you at? It's me, Delaney." The bushes parted, and there stood Daniels and his companion, guns cocked. The Mexican messenger had now drawn his gun, too. Delaney had no choice but to surrender. He stood there, swearing viciously. Presently, all five of the murderers, along with Heath, the man everyone claimed had masterminded the robbery, were in the Tombstone Jail, and their trial came fast. There was no question as to their identity or guilt, and their conviction was assured. The judge sentenced all but Heath to be hanged. Heath, he said, who had not actually participated in the robbery, but had helped plan it, had turned informer and therefore was entitled to life imprisonment. The citizens of Bisbee would have none of that. With little more ado than if rounding up a maddened bull, they rode in a body to Tombstone, ordered all officers to stand apart, and took the man Heath out. He began screaming. I recollect how people in Bisbee screamed when you all shot them down innocently, one mobster remarked, laconically adjusting a noose. They left him, hooded and kicking, dangling from the crossbar of a telegraph pole. They allowed the law to take care of the remaining five. Sheriff Ward had a gallows erected big enough to hold all at once. The five traps controlled by one pull of a string, and immediately the court order was carried out. The sheriff pulled back five black stockings on as many heads. He put on the ropes. He waited, head bared, while a priest spoke briefly. Hundreds of men and a few women, all deadly silent but intent, surrounded the gallows. As the priest closed his prayer, a few muffled sobs from relatives of those slain in Bisbee were heard in the clean, clear Arizona air. Sheriff John Ward jerked the trap string. Black ghosts? They were black hooded and black of character. Soon, they were motionless. Black ghosts forever. True West Magazine, August 1960 edition. Buffaloed Bulls. With the report heard all over the arena, the huge head received the bull's charge unmoved. What could a mangy old buffalo do to a fighting Spanish bull? By Charles Whalen Town. Can an American bison lick a Mexican fighting bull? This question was decisively answered 53 years ago in one of the strangest contests ever staged south of the border. In addition to the animals involved, five Americans and one Mexican participated, either as promoters or sponsors. They included three South Dakotans, Bob Yokin, Pierre, saloon keeper, and two fellow townsmen, Eb Jones, 40-year-old cowman, and George Phillip, range rider and budding young lawyer. Two Texans, Tom Powers and Billy Amonet, operators of the Coney Island Bar in El Paso. And one Mexican, Felix Robert, matador and manager of the Juarez Bull Ring across the river from El Paso. The gutsy South Dakotans had frequently asserted that any good rugged buffalo, sound in wind and limb, could outlast the best fighting bull that ever lived. The Mexican had his doubts, but being an alert opportunist and eager to make a fast buck, manager Robert put his arena and a string of toros at the disposal of the challengers, contracted to split the gate receipts 50-50 with the gringos, and scheduled a widely advertised combat for a Sunday afternoon in January 1907. Fortunately, the promoters from Pierre had near at hand the raw material with which to make good their boast. From a large bison herd at the Scotty Phillip Ranch on the Missouri, two specimens were selected, one 8 and the other 4 years old. With considerable trouble, tears, and toil, the two were corralled, crated, and hauled on sleds over the snow to Fort Pierre and across the frozen river to Pierre, the railroad terminus. Here, a boxcar had to be heavily reinforced with 4x4 timbers and 2-inch planking, since a kick from a buffalo's hind leg can make that of an army mule seem as ineffectual as a panhandler's knock on the kitchen door. Having fortified the two ends of the car, the space between the stalls was stored with hay and the necessary gear for watering and feeding. With the signing on of Yoakum, Jones, and Philip as water boys, chambermaids, and babysitters, the train pulled out of Pierre in the midst of a raging blizzard. This was of no concern to the fur-bearing passengers in the boxcar, but their shivering valets could hardly be enticed from the hot stove in the caboose until the train reached Sioux City, where they managed to properly feed and water the stock. Here, Hokum took a run-out pill. "Got to get down to El Paso and make arrangements for crossing the international boundary," he said. But Jones and Philip had a hunch that the companionship of Powers and Aminette and their well-stocked cantina loomed large in Yoakum's plans. When the train chuffed into Omaha, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. Departure was scheduled for 6:30 a.m., but the two travelers were glad to pay for a four-hour flop in a hotel bed. However, when the train pulled out at daylight, the Buffalo car was missing. A few hours later, our heroes located it 10 miles out where it had been sidetracked by a bumbling trainman after discovering their mistake. Eventually, it was coupled onto another freight and again began to roll. Jones and Philip were trying to sleep on the hard slats of a Rock Island caboose when a gravel-voiced trainman woke them. "Hi, would you fellers like to see the caboose you ought to have left Omaha in this morning? If you would, look on the left side of the train when we get to the next curve." They looked. There, along the right-of-way, smashed to kindling, lay the caboose, wrecked by a rear-end collision. Thereafter, there was no more grousing about the delay in Omaha. At McPherson, Kansas, there was another halt, this one for 36 hours. Here they dawdled away the time at rotation pool at 10 cents a game. But since the pair had no more skill with a cue than a hen with a toothpick, the interminable pastime yielded little profit for the house. Meanwhile, train after train rolled by, paying no attention to the Buffalo car. Furthermore, thanks to Carry Nation, Kansas was as dry as a desiccated prune in an Arizona solarium, and our friends were thirsty. But Lady Luck was on to her job. Young Philip was wearing a watch charm, displaying a double eagle. After a double take, the pool room boss thought he recognized a fellow member of the Fraternal Order of Eagles. Following a bit of mumbo-jumbo and a few mysterious passes, the brother conducted them both to an outdoor shack, where cases of beer were stacked to the ceiling. Although Yoakum had left them plenty of whiskey, they craved beer. The bottle and bond stuff had remained untasted. But Wassel had hardly started when another freight hove in sight and picked up the stalled rolling stock, which now resumed its jolting journey across the Oklahoma and Texas panhandles. At Dalhart, the travelers discovered that the new conductor was a brother-in-law of one of their close friends in Fort Pierre. This called for opening up the grips and offering him a drink. The conductor refused to tipple, but other trainmen fairly leaped for the liquor once when young Philip got out to stretch his legs, leaving Jones snoring in the caboose. The engineer, a moose of a man, invited him to ride in the locomotive, but before Philip could climb into the cab, the engineer barked, "Ain't you fellows kind of stingy?" "What do you mean?" asked Philip. "You've got liquor back there. Looks like you might give the engineer a nip." Philip promptly hurried back to the caboose. When he returned, carrying a full bottle, there was a simultaneous pulling out of the train and the cork. The engineer seemed to be suffering from an unquenchable thirst. By the time he had finished most of the quart, he had the old hogback reeling off 50 miles an hour and was singing obscene songs and applauding himself with repeated shrieks of the whistle. This was too much for the conductor. Over the car tops and into the cab skittered the infuriated little man, barely a shoulder high to the engineer. Trying to seize the throttle, He was handed a solar plexus and landed in the coal. Whereupon, the engineer gave her another notch, and the train went careening down the rails at 60 miles an hour. All at once, over the flattest terrain in all Texas, in the smoke, there billowed a plume of smoke. It was the crack Golden State Limited. But in the cab of the Galloping Goose, the unseen conductor and the crocked engineer continued their fight for the throttle. Fortunately, the passenger engineer was sober and sagacious. He saw that something was amiss and promptly detoured his Pullmans to a spur track. This was probably the last time in railroad history where a passenger train would be sidetracked for buffaloes. Meanwhile, on hurtled the alcoholic special. Whistles screaming, cars rattling, trainmen hanging on to car steps preparing to jump. With a drunken yell from the cab, a screech from the whistle, and a rat-a-tan of hoof beats from the buffalo car, the freight zoomed past the Golden State like a misguided missile grazing a bystander. It slowed down only when a few minutes later, the toss pot at the throttle pulled up at a frontier beanery, which offered nourishment for all comers, drunk or sober. In the early morning hours of Sunday, 1 week after leaving Pierre, the train reached El Paso. As the fight had been scheduled for that day, Jones and Philip quickly looked up Yoakum. But that worthy had done nothing in the way of buttering up Mexican officials for an easy crossing of the border. However, Charlie Burney, El Paso superintendent of the Mexican Central Railroad, was cooperative, and the side door Pullman, now piloted by a sober engineer, was hauled across the river and spotted the uploading chute of the Plaza de Toros. Here, Felix Robert and a crowd of aficionados crowded about for a look-see at the curly-haired curios from Yankee Land. Four regular bullfights, men against beasts, had been scheduled as preliminaries. This was to be climaxed by a fighting toro pitted against a peace-loving buffalo. On hand were more than 3,000 spectators, Mexicans of all classes, from peons to plutocrats, and a lot of Texans from across the river. In due course, several bulls succumbed to the swords of the matadors, but the crowd, growing impatient, began to chant derisively that the gringos were suffering from cold feet and would fail to show. Suddenly, the door under the arched entrance opened, and in limped the larger buffalo. It was then discovered that the fetlock joint of the left hind leg had been dislocated, probably due to a box stall injury during the wild ride across Texas. But the natives were good sports, and heartily applauded this strange-looking animal who stood quietly in the middle of the ring, his massive head despondently lowered, his retractable landing gear somewhat bent. When the door again opened, in dashed a handsome red fighting bull. At sight of the buffalo, he became visibly annoyed. The hair rose on his muscular shoulders. He pawed the earth, shook his head, and snorted defiance. Then he charged. The buffalo never moved. He stood with his body at a quartering angle to the bull. This looked like an easy target for the sharp horns of the toro, but few men and beasts living south of the border are familiar with the ways of the bison. Cattle pivot on their hind legs, buffalo on their forelegs. Thus, at the instant of contact, the buffalo's hindquarters miraculously swung away. With the report heard all over the arena, the huge head received the bull's charge unmoved, as Gibraltar might have deflected a besieger's stone from an ancient catapult. The bull was no quitter. He backed away and charged again, with the same result. Now the buffalo put a little more steam into his act and knocked the enemy to its haunches. Still game, the bull tried a third assault. Now the buffalo was really warmed up. He swung his hindquarters out of the way and butted the bull with tremendous force. As a result of this massive retaliation, the toro collapsed, with about as much fight left in him as a flower smelling Ferdinand in Spain. He staggered to his feet and wobbled to the ringside barrier. Claiming the right to substitute another contender, manager Robert brought in a second bull with the same result. Three times he charged the buffalo, unsuccessfully, then turned tail and fled. A third animal met the same fate. Three panicky toros were now circling the arena in a frenzy of fear. By now, the prepotent pride of Pierre had lost all interest in the game. He laid down in the middle of the ring and disposed himself for slumber. The crowd went wild with enthusiasm, cheering and applauding this four-legged battering ram. Manager Robert insisted on turning in a fourth bull. Again, three passes failed to jar the buffalo. Instead, being really peeved at having his nap interrupted, he started to chase all four of the terrified toros. Because of his injured leg, the champ lacked sufficient speed to catch any of them. So the gates were opened, and the four victims of Byzantine prowess, literally buffaloed, hightailed it to the corrals. A week later, there was another ludicrous aftermath. Following another round of Corridas de Toros, starring a skilled and gaudily dressed matador, it was planned to stage a contest between the man and buffalo. This time, it was the younger, the four-year-old animal, which a fearless matador named Cuco was expected to dispatch with his sword. To the knowledgeable Dakotans, this seemed an impossible assignment, for over the heavily muscled hump of the bison, nature has placed a tough hide, an inch thick, and over that, an almost impenetrable blanket of matted, woolly hair. Furthermore, the greater height of the beast compared with the fighting bull makes him a more difficult target for the man with the sword. Yet Cuco was confident. So much so, his self-assurance prompted manager Robert to accost Yoakum. "I'll bet you $500 Cuco kills your buffalo," said Yoakum. "Hell, I'll give you better than that. I'll bet you $500 the buffalo kills Cuco." The bet was laid, but never paid, as will be seen. Come Sunday, with the governor of Chihuahua presiding over a packed arena, following a colorful parade of participants, in dashed the beautiful red fighting bull that had opened the show against the larger bison the week before. But strange to say, although this was to be a conventional man-against-bull with not a buffalo in sight, no amount of chousing could get the bull haired up. The combined efforts of horses, bandoleros, picadors, peons, capas, and muletas were a flop. The brute kept trying to climb the barrier, so ardently did he want out. Then followed a scene unparalleled in the history of bullfighting. One after another, three more animals were shoved into the arena. Each, in turn, refused to fight. Each, in turn, was retired to the stalls. The faint trace of bison B.O. hovering over the ring, like powder smell over an old battlefield, was too much for them. The advertised four fights ended in a complete fiasco. Manager Robert was frantic. To the Dakotans, he wailed, "The president will call off the show and make us return the money." "Well, what do you propose to do about it?" asked the Americans. "We'll turn in the buffalo and see if he will fight just the toros." "Just have your men stick a sword or one of those picks in the buffalo, and by gad, he'll fight." Amid the clamor of the disgruntled crowd, the younger buffalo was hurried onto the scene. He was obviously looking for trouble. But when a few confalo spoiling for a fight, and Cuco aching to fight him. But the president was adamant. The customers filed out, collected their entrance money, and went home. The downhearted Dakotans crossed the international bridge and sought a consolatory dram at the Coney Island Bar. The next morning, a deal was made with an El Paso butcher to buy the two buffaloes at $200 each. He figured he'd hang their carcasses in his shop as an advertising stunt. Crossing the bridge to Juarez to get the two animals, the Yankee empresarios in overalls found manager Felix in his tiny office in bad humor, flanked by fierce Mexican rurales armed with six-shooters. Felix refused to give up the buffaloes. They were to be his from there out. "I lost $1,500 in expenses on yesterday's show," he shouted. "I'm going to sue you fellers for that amount, and I'm going to put you in jail until I get ready to sue." In Mexico, the Northerners reflected there was no right of habeas corpus. They did not hanker to languish in a Mexican juzgado indefinitely. They decided to arbitrate. Loud talk subsided and a deal was made. Robert would take the pick of the two buffaloes. The butcher would get the other. The manager chose the older. The butcher got the younger. With the meatman's $200 in their poke and a stirrup cup in hand at the friendly establishment of Powers and Amanet, things began to look brighter. Eventually, Pierre welcomed back its three bullmasters, whose reminiscences were somewhat beclouded by one unresolved issue. Could Cuco have killed the buffalo, or would the buffalo have killed Cuco? Perhaps a partial answer was forthcoming from a widely traveled lady who appeared in Pierre long after she had seen the show at Juarez. Asked what had become of the Felix Robert buffalo, she said that several weeks after the fiasco, when the brute's leg had fully healed, it was advertised to fight another bull at Juarez. A pen had been built in the center of the ring, made of 4x4 timbers, with a chute leading to it from the stalls. The buffalo was run in, and a fighting bull followed. Under this arrangement, there could be no escape. The bull fought and was killed. Two others met the same fate. When a fourth was run in, the buffalo broke the pen as he shoved his dying opponent through the side. There was no clamor from the crowd for a refund. As for what eventually became of Old Champ, the lady said, "I don't really know, but the story I heard is that they took him to Chihuahua and fought him there against the bulls. Then he was shipped to Mexico City to fight still more bulls, and the last rumor was that he was in Madrid." The lady may have been right, but there is still no answer to the 53-year-old question. Could Cuco have killed the buffalo, or would the buffalo have killed Cuco?
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.